don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. All right, so it's been a while. Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. It's been a while since I've hit one on economics, and I do read a ton of stuff on it, but I don't want to hit it too much on the podcast because this is a crypto podcast, and I prefer economic discussions that are specifically about crypto. But today I want to hit one. This is from Mises.org. If you have not been there, I definitely encourage you to do some digging around in there, particularly if you want a base in economic theory and kind of the Austrian theory of the business cycle and credit cycles, because they're absolutely key to understanding, honestly, the need for Bitcoin's monetary policy, and more importantly, why this hedge is so critical in our current financial environment. So many times I will have discussions with people on Twitter who don't even know that centrally controlled interest rate manipulation by the central bank and the centralized governments, they don't even think of it as price controls. And not only is it price controls, it's one of the most fundamental and broadly affecting price control that you can possibly do in any economy. So it's not like a small price control. It is literally the most critical price control you could possibly engage in, which arguably and obviously is why every government wants to be in charge of it. So I want to hit one today on Mises.org by Louis Aronne, titled "How Central Banking Increased Inequality." And let's go ahead and jump in. Although today high levels of inequality in the United States remain a pressing concern for a large swath of the population, monetary policy and credit expansion are rarely mentioned as a likely source of rising wealth and income inequality. Focusing almost exclusively on consumer price inflation, many economists have overlooked the redistributive effects of money creation through other channels. One of these channels is asset price inflation and the growth of the financial sector. The rise in income inequality over the past 30 years has, to a significant extent, been the product of monetary policies fueling a series of asset price bubbles. Whenever the market booms, the share of income going to those at the very top increases. When the boom goes bust, that share drops somewhat, but then it comes roaring back even higher with the next asset bubble. The Cantillon effect. The redistributive effects of money creation were called Cantillon effects by Mark Blogg after the Franco-Irish economist Richard Cantillon, who experienced the effect of inflation under the paper money system of John Law at the beginning of the 18th century. Cantillon explained that the first ones to receive the newly created money see their incomes rise, whereas the last ones to receive the newly created money see their purchasing power decline as consumer price inflation comes about. Following Cantillon, and contrary to Fisher and other monetary theorists of his time, Ludwig von Mises was the first to emphasize these Cantillon effects in terms of marginal utility analysis. With an increase in the stock of money, the cash balances of the early receivers of the newly created money increase. Correspondingly, the marginal utility they give to money decreases, and the individuals in question buy either investment or consumption goods, thus bidding up the prices of those goods and increasing the cash balances of their sellers. With this step-by-step process, the price of goods will increase only progressively and affect both the distribution of income and wealth, as well as the different price ratios. Financialization, asset price inflation, and inequality. In accordance with the Cantillon effect, inflation can increase inequality depending on the channel it takes. But increasing inequality is not a necessary consequence of inflation. If it happened that the poorest in society were the first receivers of the newly created money, then inflation could very well be the cause of decreasing inequality. Under modern central banking, however, money is created and injected into the economy through the credit channel and first affects financial markets. Under this system, commercial banks and other financial institutions are not only the first receivers of the newly created money, but are also the main producers of credit money. This is so because banks can grant loans unbacked by base money. In a free banking system, this credit creation power of banks is strictly limited by competition and the clearing process. Under central banking, however, the need for reserves is relaxed, as banks can either sell financial assets to the central bank in open market operations, or the central bank can grant loans to banks at relatively low interest rates. In both cases, central banks remove the limits of credit expansion by determining the total reserves in the banking system. In other words, commercial banks and other financial institutions are credited with so-called base money that has not existed before. Thus, the economics of Cantillon effects tells us that financial institutions benefit disproportionately from money creation, since they can purchase more goods, services, and assets for still relatively low prices. This conclusion is backed by numerous empirical illustrations. For instance, the financial sector contributed massively to the growth of billionaires' wealth. See the table below. Begin chart. So this is just a list of data points as far as percentage growth in certain areas of the economy, and includes resource-related, new sectors, non-traded sectors, the financial sector, traded sectors, and then other sectors. And it's basically the comparison of wealth growth in each of those versus the growth in the number of billionaires. The largest portion of wealth growth is absolutely in the financial sector for the United States, both in overall wealth and then also in the growth of number of billionaires. For overall wealth, it's a full 35%, where the additional 65 is split between five other sectors at 2.8%, 22, 23, 14, and 2. And then the growth in the number of billionaires in the financial sector is 41.6%, just under 42% of all new billionaires between 1996 and 2014 came directly from the financial sector. Whereas for the resource related, it's 4%, new sectors is 19%, non-traded sectors is 16%. Traded sectors is roughly 15, and then other sectors is roughly 5. So it goes to show that clearly the financial markets were grossly inflated in comparison to all the other sectors. End chart. We can list four main reasons why the growth of financial markets is triggered by an expansion of the money supply. One, because financial titles are often used as collateral in debt contracts. Two, because the anticipation of price inflation, which is a common trait among all fiat money regimes, discourages the hoarding of money, thus encouraging both the demand for and the supply of financial titles. And three, because the production of money through central banks is a matter of sheer human will and is therefore prone to developing moral hazard in the financial world. This leads to an artificially high demand for financial titles and increases the supply of such titles by the same token. And four, because the manipulation of credit by central banks and banks by lowering the interest rate in the short run particularly affects the demand for capital and the capital structure during the course of the business cycle. One of the most visible consequences of this growth of financial markets triggered by monetary expansion is asset price inflation. In a completely sound money system where credit only depends on the amount of savings rather than on fiduciary credit, there's very little room for generalized and persistent asset price inflation, as the amount of funds which can be used to purchase assets is strictly limited. In other words, the phenomenon of asset price inflation is a child of credit inflation. Asset price inflation, in turn, benefits mostly the richest in society for several reasons. First, the wealthy tend to own more financial assets than the poor in proportion to his income. Second, it is easier for the richest individuals to contract debt in order to buy shares that can be sold later at a profit. Since credit easing lowers the interest rate and therefore funding costs, the profits made by selling inflated assets bought at credit will be even greater. And finally, asset price inflation coming with the growth of financial markets will benefit the workers, managers, traders, etc., working in the financial sector. It will also benefit the CEOs of the publicly traded companies, who will be paid more as the capitalization value of their company increases. Hence, the correlation between asset prices and income inequality has been, as expected, very strong. Begin chart. It shows a chart all the way dating back to roughly 1940. Looks like maybe 1945 is when the actual data starts. Upwards of today, and it's got the blue line of the top 0.01% U.S. income share, including capital gains, and then the S&P deflated by the CPI on the right axis, which is a red line, and it just shows a pretty incredible correlation of as the S&P grows according to the CPI, the deflation rate in comparison. We see the top 0.01% U.S. income share also grow in accordance with it. End chart. However, most monetary economists ignored and continue to ignore asset price inflation and do not see it as a consequence of an inflated money supply. A reader of A Monetary History of the U.S. in 1963 by Friedman and Schwartz, or of Alan Meltzer's A History of the Federal Reserve in 2004, will not find one mention of asset price inflation. This oversight leads to the effects of inflation on inequality to be underestimated or ignored. Periods of growing inequality and monetary inflation, such as the 1920s or the 2000s, were associated with a high rate of asset price inflation, but relatively stable consumer prices. Therefore, to focus on consumer price inflation as the only variable accounting for monetary policy leaves out most of the effects of money creation on inequality. Since the 2008 financial crisis, the so-called unconventional monetary policies have often been justified on the ground that something must be done in the short run, since, as would have said J.M. Keynes, quote, "in the long run, we are all dead," end quote. But as our monetary system tends to increase inequality, and if the goal is to improve the standards of living of the least well-off in society, central banking and artificial monetary creation may be more costly than usually assumed by policymakers. All right, and that will close out our article. Again, that was on Mises.org. If you don't keep up with them, just to kind of have an idea of what's going on in the economy and kind of the macro international economic state of things, I definitely encourage you to do so, particularly if you love this topic as much as I do. I did want to hit a couple of things specifically, though, that were in this article that I thought really underestimated or kind of missed, or maybe kind of a key element in it. There was one earlier on in the article, and I'll read the quote. "In accordance with the Cantillon effect, inflation can increase inequality depending on the channel it takes. But increasing inequality is not a necessary consequence of inflation. If it happened that the poorest in society were the first receivers of the newly created money, then inflation could very well be the cause of decreasing inequality." End quote. Now, I would actually argue that this is wrong. It's just a different form of inequality created in redistribution. because monetary inflation by its nature is a redistributive effect. And yes, you could create, you could redistribute from the rich to the poor using inflation that was pushed into the poor communities, or where the asset or the money creation first existed in the lower income communities. But that completely ignores the fact that there is another redistributive effect that's got nothing to do with the specifically the rich or the poor that is still happening, that is still utterly wrong. And that's that it is a movement from savers to debtors. People who have been productive and saved capital in the underlying inflated currency, and then people who have taken on debts and made promises that they cannot make back in that currency. So it doesn't matter if it's within the poor community or within the rich community, you are redistributing by creating inflation from anybody who has been productive and saved to anybody who is unproductive or taken on debt. So, and I think in a completely flat income situation, that is wrong. Absolutely, both immoral and stupid from an economic standpoint. Productive people should be rewarded for being productive. And that reward should at least include the ability to keep that value until they want to consume it later. If nothing else, have that value increase for not making immediate consumption. An analogy that I think I've used on the podcast before, but I always like to use to explain, I think hits two major points for money. First, it explains why it is that money is actually virtual at its core, that the real underpinnings of money is a virtual thing. And then, in addition, it explains why savings is incredibly healthy for the economy, that quote-unquote hoarding money is not a bad thing. And that's using money as a tally for favors. And favors are not only a form of currency today, but arguably the very first form of currency, because it's the most natural. It's, you know, I have, like we're in a tribe or something, or a family, thousands, tens of thousands of years ago, I go out, hunt and kill a deer, and I feed everybody in the family. Well, then, you know, we all naturally, whether we're even quote-unquote keeping tallies specifically or not, we are all recognizing that everybody pretty much owes me a meal, because I have given that meal to everybody else in the family. So we have all unconsciously put up a tally in our own minds that said, I owe one unit of meal to this other person. And that's money. That's what money is at its heart. The problem with that system is that it doesn't scale. It's a very, very micro economic currency, in the sense that I cannot keep favors that, you know, from somebody in China or somebody that I don't know anything about, somebody I'll never see in my life. I can't trade a favor with my brother to somebody in the UK. Like, they're never going to, they don't know my brother, they can't trust my brother, how the hell do they know they're going to get that favor back? And one favor is not equal to another favor. There's no way to independently measure them against each other. And that's where the underlying tool of money came in, is that how can we sustain some of the key properties of a favor, but create an independent means of valuing that tally system, which is essentially what a list of favors are, or is. And funny enough, the absolute earliest writings of anything, the earliest ones in human history, are tallies. They're literally a ledger of, it's just accounting. Accounting was first, and you could argue that accounting was actually, or excuse me, spoken language was actually a consequence of needing to define and keep tabs on what it is that we owed each other so that we could have a traded society that was way, way, way more productive. And so that, you know, you don't forget a favor, or you don't forget what it is exactly that we traded, and so on and so forth. So I think that's a huge key to the entire thing. And to be able to inflation, regardless of whether or not it makes the rich richer and the poor poorer, or the poor richer and the rich poorer, it is always making the producers poorer and the debtors richer by devaluing the favor that was already consumed and devaluing the favor that someone has already given. So it would be like getting a 10% inflation in the context of me giving someone a meal for like a deer hunt. It would be like saying, okay, well, in 6 months, I'll pay you back half a meal. And my additional consumption and productivity at the beginning of that was punished by 50%. When in reality, I should have made interest on that because I'm having to make up the difference in the meantime, waiting for my favor to be paid back. And whereas the other person who made the false promise or the promise they couldn't keep now gets a refund for half the meal, even though they ate the full thing. So that's why I think inflation is morally wrong, regardless of whether it decreases or increases inequality between the rich and the poor, because I think that's a complete dodging of what is actually happening with inflation, which is a redistributive effect, regardless of where it is in the economy, between the people who are doing favors and not asking for anything in return, and the people who are taking favors and not giving anything for it. And then the next thing I wanted to hit was a quote. I'll go ahead and just hit the quote. It's, quote, because the anticipation of price inflation, which is a common trait among all fiat money regimes, discourages the hoarding of money, thus encouraging both the demand for and the supply of financial titles. End quote. So this is something that, this is such a hard topic because the misunderstandings of this element, and it's addressed by the idea of money as a set of favors or a tally of favors, is that people, somehow it has become grossly widespread of a fallacy to think that people hoarding money is bad for the economy. And more importantly, it's bad for the poor, or, you know, you're keeping something that other people need. When in reality, that is so perfectly the opposite of what is happening. And we'll, I'll have to refer back to that analogy here to actually explain this. So hoarding money is a very, very widespread, or the evils, quote unquote, of hoarding money is a very widespread fallacy that actually gets people to desire and essentially beg for exactly the type of policies that punish them the most. And there's a couple of key, there's really two critical mistakes there. First, money is not a resource. You cannot do anything with money. Money is a proxy for other resources, for actual items of utility. A unit of money, you can't make a sword out of a unit of money. You cannot eat a unit of money. You cannot make a shirt out of a unit of money. You can use it to purchase cotton that will make a shirt, or the time to make a shirt, but it is not time in and of itself. It does not mean, for someone to hoard money does not mean there are few resources available. It does not mean that there is less food to go around, and it does not mean there is less time available to people. It is nothing more than a way of measuring external resources. So it's claiming that hoarding money is keeping resources from people is literally like saying hoarding a bunch of inches is like keeping space from people. So, two, withdrawing money from the economy has a wealth effect for everyone who is left in it. Let me explain. So, per our previous example here with money as favors, what is the act of saving exactly? Let's say I work at a job where I make sandwiches, and I save 80% of the sandwiches that I make. I save the money for 80% of the sandwiches that I make. What I have done, let's say I've produced 100 sandwiches, and I have saved the money from 80 of those sandwiches. What that means is that I have given the economy, the pool of resources in the economy now has 80 more sandwiches than I have consumed. I have added to the pool of resources and made that available to other people. And this is exactly the same regardless of what service or resource or product I produce. The act of saving means that you are producing hours of work. You are giving a service, you are giving a product into the economy, and therefore increasing its supply without asking for anything in return. You're not taking any other resources out of the economy. And what that actually does is lower the price of those goods and increase the price or increase the value and the amount of consumption available from those who have less of the monetary resource while simultaneously bringing down the price of the resource. It's a multiple. If everybody across the economy is saving half of their income, what it is doing is creating vast surpluses of all goods across the economy that will result in significantly lower prices and, as a consequence, greater purchasing power of particularly the lower incomes that do not have that available to them. So let's say the lower incomes cannot save. Well, that means that their fixed income is twice as much, will buy them twice as much because everyone else has saved half of their economic productivity and withdrawn it from the economy. They've withdrawn their consumption from the economy, leaving more available to the people who don't have the privilege of saving money because they don't make enough. They're on fixed incomes. So hoarding money is exactly what puts the poorest people in society in a higher standard of living. It's exactly what gives them more resources available to consume by not consuming it yourself. It's doing a favor without asking for anything in return. So what happens when you do the opposite? What happens when you actually start punishing people for hoarding the money? Well, again, money is not a resource. So if it's not holding its value, if it can't just stay constant, which is the whole purpose of money, that is the number one utility of money, is I have produced something today and I don't have anything today specifically that I want back. So I want to keep it in an asset that will stay as valuable as the thing that I just traded and transport that value into the future without degrading it or without it rotting or breaking or, you know, so on and so forth. I want that value to stay there so that maybe next year I can finally find something that, okay, I want that favor back now. This is a great thing to spend my money on that produces a lot of value and really makes my life better for a very reasonable price. I have transported that value over time by holding it in a non-consumable asset that doesn't do anything else, which is exactly what you want. What happens when you start punishing by devaluing that asset in particular, they start removing actual useful assets from the economy. They start purchasing financial assets. They start purchasing commodities and driving those prices up by immediately dumping their consumption. So rather than having a surplus of 80 sandwiches, like in my previous example, I just purchased 80 sandwiches of value back out of the economy of stuff that people actually need, of food, of a television, or whatever else. And even worse is because I didn't actually want that item, I'm both raising its price and putting the money in a place that I don't find as valuable as I would have had I waited a year and spent on something more efficient. So it increases just the idea of consumerism at large by forcing me to just go out and buy something that's going to maintain its value, that's an actual resource, as opposed to waiting for something that might be twice as valuable to me personally, or particularly gain some efficiency or benefit that I can't currently get at this very moment with that consumption. So it's like going into a store and, you know, there's not anything particularly that you want, or you're not very hungry or something. So it's like, well, I'll just do this tomorrow. But instead, you know, somebody's got, well, I'm going to take $10 out of your pocket if you don't buy anything. every time you go into the store and you don't find anything valuable, it's like, all right, well, I'll buy something that's a whole lot less valuable and give that money to some institution that's not really producing something I desperately want right now. I just don't want to lose my value. So it redistributes capital and consumption into the hands of people, into the hands of products or services that might not even really be that valuable, just something that I can do now to not lose the value. So it encourages, and at the same time, because you're increasing consumption today, it's raising those prices, therefore making anybody on a fixed income lose the like base natural benefit of a productive and high surplus economy by turning around and immediately consuming real resources, as opposed to holding a what is essentially a useless a it's not useless but it's a non-resource unit of account. So both decreasing the supply of actual goods in the economy and increasing the prices of them, or at least not allowing the price to decrease, and which would benefit the poorest in society, in addition, build up a surplus that allows us to survive contractions or disasters or, you know, unforeseen circumstances like a major storm or something like that. If we have that surplus ready to go, then we counter huge price spikes in some of these resources. Whereas if we have no savings ready to go, something as basic as a storm can cause 10 times as much damage, specifically because it also vastly increases prices. We have no surplus to move into the area to solve the huge shortage. Like, it just, the problems compound on themselves. And the incentives, the core incentives in both situations, hoarding money is good for the economy. It means extra favors are in the economy. It means we're running a surplus. It means that the entire economy as a whole, the entire pool of resources, has increased, and people are not consuming, leaving the lowest in the society, the lowest income, fixed income individuals, in the best possible situation with high supply of goods and low supply of money, making their fixed income more valuable and go further, increasing the overall standard of living, which is the best possible thing for the poor. Whew. Okay. All right. Yeah, I think that's everything I wanted to hit. got a little intense there. It's hot. I'm making, just so y'all know, I think this is hilarious because my wife gives me crap about it. I actually record this thing in like, you know, when you make forts when you're little with like your blankets and pillows and all that good stuff. I basically make one of these over top of my desk in the living room that I can just break down and throw back up. And it gets incredibly hot, particularly when I get really antsy or really worked up about this. Like, you know, I'll rant about these things and get really intense about it and start straining. And then a couple minutes later, I'm like sweating in my little hot box of nerd energy that I've got going on in here. So we will close there. Hopefully you guys liked the little economics lesson. I know I don't hit economics much on the podcast. Let me know if you enjoy this episode and if you appreciate hitting this every once in a while, because Mises was very, very appreciative and incredibly generous about all of their content. I asked, and they just thought it was wonderful that I wanted to read their stuff, and I asked way before I even started the podcast. They were like, yeah, that would be awesome. Feel free to read anything we could possibly post on the website. It's all open. I love the initiative, all that great stuff. They were totally great about it. So I have basically free rein to read anything on their website, and I encourage everybody to check it out. The Mises Institute does just a monumental amount of work and is such a good resource for what's going on both economically and honestly from a lot of principles of liberty, like perspective. I read them constantly, even though I don't hit them on the podcast, just because this is a crypto-centric podcast. So I want to drive people to that website. If you don't know and you want a little bit, learn a little bit of economics, Mises.org is the place to be. All right, guys. Don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter and Medium. subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and share it with all of your friends so everyone in the crypto economy can learn about all the coolest stuff going on with Bitcoin and economics and the history of the cypherpunks. If you would like to support the show, as usual, I have my Trezor link, the affiliate link for the Trezor hardware wallet. I will have it both in the post and the show notes. So if you ever go get your hardware wallet, which I highly recommend if you're holding any amount, any significant amount of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, get yourself a hardware wallet. Use my affiliate link. You'll thank me later. They're really great, and it just makes you sleep easy at night. So use that affiliate link. If you've got a link for the Trezor shop, change it out. Swap out that bookmark for my affiliate link. It sends me a couple of dollars, and there's no cost or anything different for you. It's a great way to help out the show. And of course, if you are not a Trezor fan or do not want to use a hardware wallet, or of course you already have your hardware wallet, feel free to donate to the Bitcoin address that I will have in the Twitter post and the show notes. So thank you guys so much for listening, and I will catch you all tomorrow. This has been the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, everybody.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.